Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another one of our democratization streams.
Indeed.
We promised you some World War II, and boy, have you got a lot of World War II now. But
Yes.
it is a very vital topic.
Good evening, everybody, and
We're
welcome
joined
to another
by
one of
our
our
eternal
democratization streams.
researcher
Indeed.
and very valued guest, Evelyn, who is in great pain, I will add, because she hurt her back earlier today walking across the room.
Yeah, I'm making a great sacrifice today
She
for
is.
the people.
It's for democracy. I mean, for the people, yes.
That'd be the last thing it'd be for.
How did you do that? You were just walking across the room, knackered back.
Unironically, yes. I don't know if I've got like a trapped nerve, but like a whole big section of my back's like all inflamed and I can't like twist at all.
Jesus. Oh, that's no good. That's no good at all. So it's not a good reason to be putting you back out.
Nah.
Now,
As always, there is, sorry, the normal YouTube-y stuff. We're still monetized somehow. If you occasionally hear an echo when the stream starts, that's just because we all have the audio up to make sure that the stream is actually starting. So there'll be maybe like a few seconds of that sometimes. But yeah, the best way to donate and for us to actually get the money is to do it through our Streamlabs.
Yes.
That is the lowest cut. And we get the most from that. And we do try and read out every single super chat, every single donation. Even you, Glowy, sending like 12 at a time. no, it's thank you for the support, guys. It's always pretty good. Even though YouTube seems to bury these streams right now, but again, from like having weird encounters with people who've had encounters with people in the wild who've been watching these, it is kind of strange to realize that there is a very dedicated audience out there, some of which were previously normies. So my apologies if you just stumbled across this, because this is like a lot for a lot of people. It's like Ark of the Covenant opening face melting stuff.
That's why it's so good, though.
No, it's been a lot of fun. Yes, hearing that recounting of the story, of literally total normie meeting friend who was telling him about this series was that was weird, wasn't
Wait,
it?
that actually happened.
Yeah,
Yeah,
that actually happened.
Yeah.
This hasn't been relayed to me yet.
No, it's a good friend of ours literally sort of came on onto the server and was just like, dudes, this guy I'm working for, who works for a very, very normie organization and is very normie, who's like talking about this, oh, this history streaming channel that he's been watching about the 19th century and the Second World War and democratization. It's they're a pair of insane libertarians, basically, although one's a bit more down to earth than the other. I'm still trying to work out which one's which.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
Where do I fit into that equation?
Yeah, that's kind of a funny one.
But yeah, no, that happened. That's weird.
As hello to the members I'm seeing in the chat there. Hello to Caleb, Bluefire, and British Knight. And again, thanks to everyone who's still. I think we've got quite a few recurring members still, even though not everyone can catch the streams live because, well, like I said, YouTube
Oops.
doesn't notify people. But again, all of that does add up and it does help. So please do give us beer money. But we're here to talk about the consequences of World War II, because really we were only able to skim a lot of the events in our previous two streams and set up some of the stuff in terms of the way that the war affected people, I guess mentally in many ways. It was this great upheaval event that led to all these changes, and it's very difficult to go through all of them, even with, I guess this will be the third stream that's over 2 hours we've had. So even in like 6 hours, it's hard to even touch on World War II as a subject, which is why it's the first thing a lot of people notice as one of the outliers of the mainstream version of history. But it is, I don't know, I hate to call it baby's first revisionism, but everyone does kind of fight over their version of World War II. But that should just show what a defining event it's been for the quote-unquote post-war consensus
Yeah,
since.
'cause the economics variation of that's like the Great Depression. It's like, how do you get to explaining the Great Depression? And there's just like 19 other versions of very silly sort of ideas of it, and there's like one version that's actually right.
Yeah, and that one version that's like, hey, you guys never paid the bill for World War II, you just said you didn't printing mo sorry, World War I and just printing more money.
Yeah.
Hey, you guys can't do that. That's illegal.
Scumbags.
You know, if I sat there with a printer and started printing out a couple of million, you know, they would be, oh boy, they would be all over me. And yeah, I must say, it is quite a shame, because I know this has happened to both you and I recently, whereby the generation that lived through the Second World War are now pretty much, there's not many of them about. There's not many people to actually tell the story firsthand anymore. And
well, that's the thing that keeps it sort of the truest version of history, is, you know, stories that get handed down from person to person.
Yeah,
those are the, you know, it's almost like a propaganda that, you know, the game of like Chinese whispers, a kid to gaslight you into thinking that stories can't be passed down from generation to generation.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's the truest ones.
I'm reminded of a bit in the X-Files.
We need to steal that at some point.
Yeah, we need to just steal that clip. That's
one for the next Shieldings event. If you want to do a thing in historiography, you use that quote and see if anyone knows where it's from.
The FBI, man.
Everyone that's watched this will know it, but...
There's a great bit in X-Files where there's a Native American basically talking about that when...
stories become history.
Yeah. When history passes out of living memory, it becomes like a tool of those against you. And it's this incredibly based talk from the Native American dude there.
But so much of that is kind of the stuff we're trying to discuss this evening, though, if we want to start getting into it.
Yeah, it is what we want to get into.
Yeah, I think we're sort of taking a slightly, you know, seeing World War II as the end of a project towards a certain narrative that may have started as early as we started describing stuff in the Progressive Era, and the transferal of the sort of Cecil Rhodes myth of sort of, you know, proto-globalism into something like, you know, the different treaties after World War One, or the United Nations, or, you know, even the sort of the earlier versions of the League of Nations as... Yeah. You know, the first step to some sort of practical attempt at a project like that.
Well, yeah. We started these streams and we never quite picked up that thread with briefly talking about Cecil Rhodes and essentially the idea of a British globalism predicated on the British Empire.
Yes. Did we ever get around to mention the Georgia Guidestones? I think that's
we all... have mentioned though. We've touched them a couple of times.
Yeah.
No, I think I do remember specifically suggesting, when we were doing some of the first episodes, that there's bits in the will of Cecil Rhodes.
Yeah.
It's like his last will and testimony or something like that. That essentially is his call for people who admired him to go on in his image and basically conquer the four corners of the world in the name of the white man.
That's basically what we said, yes. And there's a lot of people who don't seem to recognise that really that project, you know, it stopped being in the name of the white man, but it became... You can really just replace a lot of his kind of ethno-globalism with global democracy, and it is exactly the same. And that is one of the, that is why we brought him up then. We started with Cecil Rhodes and Hegel, really. It's this, again, there's a straight line from Cecil Rhodes and the kind of weird Protestant Hegelianism to the United Nations.
Yeah, and sort of underwritten within all that is this a notion that someone must be this person, or some group must be this group to go and engage in such a project. You know, if you weren't able in some sense to work out the homogeneity across the world, then it wouldn't really work.
Yes.
So as we saw in the stuff on World War One, the US coming in and trying to implement sort of democratic hegemony in Europe, or at least have an attempt at it, is essentially that you know, Cecil Rhodes kind of model.
I mean, it is.
There is some sort of argument to be said that if you can see other countries and other leaders all thinking the same thing, you may as well get in, so you've actually got a foot in the game, so to speak, or maybe even control it. It's like the old arguments of that Maggie Thatcher was, oh, we're in the EU, not because we want to be in the EU, but so we can, you know, bugger it up for the rest of Europe, or at least essentially.
There's the sort of angle that Rothbard questions kind of roughly in some of his Progressive Era stuff, which is maybe some of these people were actually Machiavellian actors and understood what they were. And, you know, that's part of the thing we've been trying to explain explaining them as managerialists, that this is a deliberate move to engage in greater social engineering within society. And that once that becomes an internationalist project, you engage in nation building.
Yes.
Yes. I don't know if I'm going to put on that first slide there, Trig. Because the UN building always looks so fucking creepy to me.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same as what the Chinese and the Soviets had. It's very kind of, it's very Politburo building. It's very KGB.
It feels like you're about to do a show trial, doesn't it? It really does.
Oh, yeah.
I apologize to Comrade Stalin. Now, please let me pay for the bullets you're going to have to have to expend on me.
I think it's a case of that it's that like that early brutalist stuff.
It's also got sort of like the 50s technocrat thing to it.
Don't start me on brutalism. Like it's the worst architecture. It's horrifying. Edification of the soul. No, you will have no beauty.
We'll probably end up going into that at some point. You know,
Scruton cries.
Scruton. Oh dear me.
Scruton, but he's a sad cat.
Sad cat Scruton. Oh no. It's okay. Here's a pretty building. Please cheer up, Scruton. He's so sad. He's looking at a block. He's looking at a scheme block.
Mm.
I know that feel. Yes.
It's a case of that. It is. It's the architecture of the post-war. You know, there was the post-war architecture. We actually just call it that because it is. It's horrible. It's this horrible kind of globalist brutalism. We'll have something, I think, if we do the whole post-democratization stuff.
Yeah, there needs to be an architectural special.
Yes. Yeah, how states build buildings, basically. Yeah.
People go, bad. Oh, it's because they had concrete and it was easy. It's like the Romans had concrete and they made it beautiful. They don't need to make it square blocks with holes in it.
No.
But yeah, I can rabbit on about why brutalism is awful for several hours, and you probably don't want to hear that. Unless you do. In which case, tell me, I will do that at something else. But yeah.
There's a couple of salient points here in that the United Nations is really a restarted League of Nations.
Mm.
League of Nations was dissolved, I think, in 1946.
Yep.
And then pretty much instantly, I think, the United Nations was founded in its place as a much more rigorous and it was not as binding as they would hope it be over time. But I think some of the fake ineptitude of the UN belies its power.
But I think it importantly still grasps onto this myth, though.
Yes.
And it still has enough influence over, you know, back as we were talking previous, it would have been the League of Nations influencing Wall Street to engage in the nation building stuff in Germany and the Soviet Union that we were talking about through Sutton's work.
Yeah, I mean, the key difference is that the America was involved in the UN rather than the Americans going, oh yes, let's build the League of Nations. Shall we join? Nah, fuck it. We won't.
That's the big difference
in
that Wilson, by the end of World War II, had fully won at home.
Yes.
His policies and after him, the policies of FDR had managed to drag by hook or by crook the American people into a, if not place of support, then a place of passivity. And that they would not actively resist the globalist forces of America as world police. Because World War One would traumatize them, but World War Two and its, you know, it's essentially lack of sacrifice.
Well, think what happened though, as much as, you know, between World War One and World War Two, you still see further universalization of the process of suffrage in America.
Yes, you do.
You know, pre-World War One America is a lot more like pre-World War One Europe, you know, in a certain sense, the further spreading of democracy Europe during World War One would be people in America looking at the world and being like, oh well, they're going to be like us.
Yes,
we must be winning.
Yes, that is true. It is the point that a lot of the political capital was spent on the universal suffrage stuff and then prohibition to really essentially soften up the domestic audience for things like this.
But, you know, it ties so far into all the stuff I'm talking about. I mean, all of this wouldn't be possible without Keynesian economics.
Yes.
Public goods infrastructure and, you know, a sort of a Benthamite utilitarianism in a much more complex and pretend scientific form.
Well, yeah. It also wouldn't be possible without the events of World War One and that first foray into being world police. That's predicated on that too. That is really, like we mentioned, that World War One, and I hopefully proved to people through quite a rigorous process that World War One is a war of central banking.
Yeah. Well, no, it is the first sort of groups of people reaping benefits from what is referred to in France as the revolution of mass and scale. You know, it's the people who received the riches from the Industrial Revolution, not just in Europe, but worldwide. And not purely just through manufacturing, but just financing it.
Yes, yeah. It's a big... I don't know, it's a big topic to handle. That's when you're trying to explain it all at once, but now that we've broken it down, I think we're starting to see really the end point fruits of that.
It's also, let's not forget, World War One was really the end of the Age of Kings in Europe and monarchs in general. Sure, England's still got a monarchy, but the end of World War One and shortly after, that was it. There was no monarchies worth speaking of that actually had any real power left, or were shortly to be gone, shall we say.
Well, I was going to say, royalty, I think, is a point we'll get into further later on as part of that kind of myth that we're talking about, but it's understanding that the project of World War One, if we want to say it in that sense, is, you know, it is all predicated on society or culture or business becoming larger, a larger entity and a larger system, more dependent on more different things within it. You know, it becomes ever more complex.
Again, we've talking about previously about how the Weimar Germany and the Soviet Union were essentially Western powers and especially Western finance projects. That the five-year plan under Lenin and the second five-year plan under Stalin were all predicated on massive injections of Western cash, machinery, and technical know-how. And the same with Weimar Germany. This was an internationalist attempt at nation-building. And there's a lot of semi-nationalized business involved there. There's a lot of quasi-governmental forces, especially with the New Deal and the involvement of the central banks. But what you end up there is like a prototype of what happens when the US or the UN, you know, goes into a country, especially in places like Africa, and essentially demolishes it and rebuilds its society in its own image.
Well, there's an important term to what they describe the process they're engaging with there that, again, will sort of come up as we get further into this kind of stuff. But they are the people who get to decide what is peacekeeping or not.
Yes. They are.
As we further delve into the stuff that Trigger mentioned about kings and sovereignty and whatever else, that will become a very important term. I think we should maybe try and, I think we've got a bit of Francis on the
we do
mass
we
and are, scale stuff to sort are. Of round off that, because I think it's a very salient point.
Well, we are reading here from Leviathan and its Enemies. It is page 9 in the weird version we've got. I'm not sure if you guys are reading along at home, because that book's a bit expensive and hard to find, but we need to get more show notes out. I've been a bit lax with those, but if we do get show notes out, it is in the...
It's page 9 after the preface, I believe, in the physical edition.
Okay. And it's page 23 in the PDF version that you can find on archive.org. Do you want to read this first one?
Yeah, I can if you want. I think, is it the first one or the two we're going for here? No, I think it might just be... Yeah, in the last half of the 19th century, in the first part of the 20th century, i.e. the sort of latter industrial revolution kind of period, in Western Europe and North America experienced a profound and unique transformation in the dominant structures of their common civilization. This transformation, comparable in its implication to those of the Neolithic transition from subsistence hunting to agricultural production, is not yet complete and will probably not end soon, which I think is just a great point. You know, the technical revolution is not over yet.
It's still so going, yes. Come.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, its essential characteristic consists in the vast and dramatic enlargement of mass and scale in almost all areas of organized human activity. The growth of mass populations concentrated in huge urban conglomerations, working in large factories and offices, producing, consuming, governing, voting, communicating and fighting on scales and in numbers that are unique in history. The principal consequence of this revolution of mass and scale has been the reorganization of human communities at all levels into structures radically different from the institutions of earlier civilizations. These new structures, mass organizations today, are the dominant, though still not the most common, forms of social organization in the Western world. and government in the form of bureaucratized mass states, whether constitutional or totalitarian in the economy, in the form of mass corporations, public agencies, and unions that direct and regulate production and consumption in society. In the form of mass churches and religious movements, mass universities and educational institutions, mass media and mass associations that contain and discipline the population. The rise and predominance of mass organisations in the 20th century constitute what Kenneth Boulding in the 1953 called the organisational revolution, the growth in size and importance of organisations of almost all kinds in the past few decades. I'll correspond to what Petrim Sorokin called colossalism and cultural ethical and aesthetic as well as in social and economic life, which sums up a lot of what we've been discussing there. You know, there is a universalizing aspect as organizations grow ever larger, even down to the level of what the buildings look like, and that there's almost a sort of sense here in the way that we're talking about before with the total state, that the ideology doesn't really matter so much once you get to a society of a certain density or organizing on a certain scale. There is a necessity for, you know, bean counters and people who are managers of stuff.
Yeah, it's the mass and scale that we see is only possible in the wake of the total state emerging. And that it starts to emerge with the Industrial Revolution, but there are people who take hold of it and deliberately enhance it. They steer it, yeah. And they realize that if you are simply a small unit in a large machine, you have no power. And that really is, I guess, one of the core theses of Leviathan its enemies is showing the process by which people are, you know, essentially disenfranchised by democracy.
Yeah.
And that their ability to take action under their own power is greatly diminished within a democratic framework under the revolution of mass and scale in a managerial state. It's, you know, it's a bit of a mouthful to talk about that stuff, but it's what you have to understand, and it's a language you have to use. You know, we were at the Shieldings event last weekend, and we were talking a little bit to Academic Agent about Leviathan and its enemies, and he mentioned it's quite repetitive, and it is in certain areas, but it's to reinforce its core message, which is all of this stems from very similar places, and there's very similar things happening in many areas of society for essentially the same reason. And you can really start to pinpoint it here with how World War II was fought and how the peace was formed, in that the revolution of mass and scale has fully taken over people's minds.
Yeah, and the end result from this era is much more the product of the need to universalize a culture and a people so much necessitates a system that actually diminishes a lot of ideologies in its total form. That's why there needs to be a lot of mealy-mouthed sort of explanations that normally don't make sense or even go to the lengths of fully contradicting themselves. Because they've got to, even though they want to frame the structure as whatever they want to, and a lot of the time they are successful in that, they also must, however, come to the terms of the fact that it's not perfect. And that ideologically it doesn't make sense, but functionally it's the only thing they can do.
Are we hearing cat noises there, Trig?
There are cat noises in the background. I have to apologise in advance. There is.
Oh, no, it's fine. If you hear what sounds like a cat fiddling around, that is a cat fiddling around. Trig has a new cat, and it is very cute.
Yeah,
although it does look a bit like a sad cat half the time.
It doesn't. He is a very happy cat. He just has a round face, and yeah.
We've had our first donation of the evening from James Murray. Thank you, James Murray, one of our regular donors.
Yeah.
He says, we can all see the evil that erupts when total states go to war, but can non-total states actually resist the aggression of the total state? It feels like a totalitarian arms race. Well, there's something that a lot of people have been talking about on social media right now, which is, you know, the Taliban.
I was going to say, yes, clearly.
Both the Taliban and the North Vietnamese are a great example of how total states are actually really bad at waging occupational wars because they are not something that is welcome in a culture that doesn't want them there. They can be outlasted because they are incredibly inefficient. War of total states, you know, as much as it likes to have the appearance of bringing all this production, is incredibly wasteful. It's incredibly inefficient.
Well, we can sort of tie that towards the point that we're wanting to go into forwards, which is that's why there is this tendency to ever-growing scale. I'm good for water. Even though it might not sound like it. No, there's this tendency for sort of ever-growing scale in the sake of efficiency or progress or expansion. And that, you know, that's all justified by a sort of just corrupt utilitarianism under the auspices that, you know, we are spreading this Cecil Rhodesian world dominance, but we're doing it because we're the good guys.
It is.
Yeah.
It's the, you know, the idea of the global level playing field, that if all countries are the same, that is somehow fairer. That is the utilitarian goal that we see in practice now with the UN. It's the assembling of the global panopticon, really. It's the idea that you cannot escape any of these ideas. You cannot escape any of these principles, no matter where you go. There is no country on Earth that will not be affected by this. And if someone doesn't sign up to it, they'll be globally ostracized. That is the point of a lot of what the UN is doing now and what a lot of the, you know, the large democracies are doing now. We've got a quote here about, I think it's to do with minimum taxation levels, actually.
Mm.
It's a quote from Hans Herman Hoppe, which is a great way to frame this, because global democracy is always framed in almost like a Gene Roddenberry sense as a means of peaceful utopia.
Mm.
This, you know, we talk about Faustian space nonsense, but this idea that we will unite the planet and explore the stars, you know, it's fun for essentially a children's TV show, as the original Star Trek demographically became.
Mm.
But as a means for actually organizing the world outside of fiction, it all falls down when you try and do it. And the rhetoric itself only ends up leveling up how powerful your elites are. There's a lot of good stuff in both Hoppe and Rothbard where they talk about the fact that if you only have local level organization, you only really have local level power, and local, you know, the top of your pyramid is a lot closer to the bottom of your pyramid.
Mm.
And as we level up the revolution of mass and scale, the elites get an ever thin strata over an ever larger underclass.
With, you know, both literally, or sorry, both figuratively and literally, in a sense of, you know, distance, you know, as the, I don't know, do you want me to do this one?
I can read this. No, keep going, keep talking.
No, because we see where this ties in greatly here. We're talking about, you know, I don't know, you, if you want to read the quote first, and I'll continue.
I can read the quote, yeah. This is from page 438 of The Great Fiction by Triple H himself, Hans Herman Hoppe.
Hoppemania.
Yes. As one approaches the limit of a one-world state, all possibilities of voting with one's feet against a government disappear. Wherever one goes, the same tax and regulation structure applies. Relief from the threat of emigration removes a fundamental rein on the expression of government expansion, sorry, of government power. This explains developments of the 20th century with World War I, and even more so with World War II. The US attained hegemony over Western Europe and became heir to its vast colonial empires. A decisive step in the direction of global unification was taken with the establishment of Pax Americana. Indeed, throughout the entire period, the US, Western Europe, and most of the rest of the world have suffered from a steady and dramatic growth of government power, taxation, and regulatory expropriation.
Mm, once again, well said by Triple H. Yeah. It's his birthday today, by the way, so I'm wanting everyone to put a happy birthday Hans in the chat.
Everybody put a birthday helicopter
better
in the chat, please.
A happy birthday, otherwise he's going to helicopter you.
Yeah, put a...
You know,
HB
isn't just
Triple H, yeah.
As you were saying, you know, it isn't just that the pyramid above you gets bigger, it's that it gets absorbed into, you know, if you're some middling European country,
yeah,
and all of a sudden you get absorbed into the Soviet Union, or some, you're some kind of thing that gets absorbed into this Pax Americana, all of a sudden that pyramid is so much bigger and you have nothing to do to affect it other than the magic ballot box.
What he's also talking about there is a symptom that affected the US at the turn of the century that we talked about. Again, it links back to the beginning of the series. It is the death of the frontier.
Mm.
It is the death of the idea that if you don't like a society, you can simply go and form your own.
Mm.
Build your own society. But within a global system, with a global set of laws and truly global government, that is, you know, no longer possible. You end up in kind of a Gundam Wing situation where you have to go found colonies in space and then try and be separatist.
Oh, no, not enough space. But that, sick of it.
But the thing is, that's where it looks to. You end up, global governance, the idea of global governance, looks to these intangible and currently impossible goals of alien contact, of space travel, but of,
it's,
you know,
to sell you on the idea that we can somehow all act as one.
Well, it's, there's also a lot of stuff about, you know, the removal of death and the singularity, and it's all this, it's removal of the everyday and essentially the removal of the human from people's goals and people's lives, and it becomes extremely, again, once you get to the 50s, it ends up getting extremely weird, because you end up with this, you know, this idea of mass scale seeping its way into people's minds and people's imaginations. And as they slowly slide into their kind of suburban mediocrity, essentially, as they all become unhappy materialists, what they're looking to is the stars. And they emerge, you know, from their waking dream in the late 60s, early 70s, you know, to get a bit ahead of ourselves, thinking, what the hell happened? When they essentially spent the 50s and the 60s sat on the couch watching the moon landings taking second all.
Meanwhile, at the same time, people during both the, you know, World War One and World War Two died for this supposed system and this supposed freedom that they live under. And that this freedom and this ability to choose, despite the fact that you are ruled over by some ever more universalizing abstract entity.
Well, we point the nose here. We need to have something that just flashes on screen saying, this is what the Silent Generation actually believed.
No, this is what the Silent Generation actually died for. It's worse.
Yeah.
Also, Trig, you've not put on our important slide.
Oops, sorry. I that was the wrong one. that was. You don't want to see Buzz Aldrin admitting that the moon landing was all an animation. Well, do you?
That's quite funny.
He literally did, you know. He did. It was what's his name? Conan O'Brien. There's a clip on YouTube with Buzz Aldrin. Conan O'Brien is there going, "Oh, I remember sitting down watching the moon landings," and Buzz Aldrin goes, "No, you didn't. You watched an animation." And then changes the subject completely and carries on talking about other stuff.
Well, you heard them, you heard the moonlight. It's just I don't know. That also just kind of sounds like Buzz Aldrin being off his meds, Buzz Aldrin. But, you know, that's just Buzz Aldrin a lot of the time. No, there's the World Peace slide, which I'm quite happy with because it is a joke.
Yes.
I don't know. You tell me this one question. I'm just going to go off track very quickly because I was asked this earlier, right? The lunar module, the lunar lander, that little thing, piece of tinfoil with a little piece of tinfoil on top of it that the guys get out of, and they get out of that, they do their stuff, and then they get back in it, and it launches off, and it goes up into the off the moon. How does that thing carry enough fuel to get to 13,000 miles an hour to dock with the orbiter that's going around the moon that's going to take it back? There is not enough fuel in it. Just saying.
Nah, that's 13,000 mile an hour orbiting speed doesn't sound right for the moon.
That sounds like that's a lot of velocity, you know.
I know. I'm just saying.
Number too high, Trig. Don't question number Hugo Prison.
don't take my note for it. Just think about it. You know,
to think of worlds.
Drawing seeds.
It is once again this idea of scale. You know, it's not just peace at home, it's peace around the world.
You know,
and it very quickly becomes by any world means peace, necessary.
World peace.
But you know, you become someone who can accrue political power or notice by playing to this narrative, though.
Yeah, we always talk about the Dark Lord himself, Tony Blair, but he's not someone who has political power in a country. He is a supranational political figure.
Well, but there is also the fact that he, as a quote we're about to get into soon at some point as well, he plays to a false tenet of nationalism when it's convenient too.
Yes, he does.
And that, you know, his nationalism is always underpinned by being a national entity within a global entity, which, you know, further point. But the very same universalism sort of exists on a smaller scale there. And that was the thinking that really got a lot of people into World War One, was considering themselves a nation of people, which a lot of countries hadn't really done at that point still.
No, if you look at Spain, you look at Germany.
Italy.
Yeah, Italy, most of Eastern Europe.
I mean, Germany only got federalized in 1870-something.
Yes, it was 1870.
And even that didn't go particularly smooth either.
Spain, Italy, still doesn't think of itself as a single country. The Basques are constantly iffy about whether or not they want to stay. So are the Catalonians. It's Spain. Spain, no. It's to be honest, given half a chance, the North would separate from the South and the Midlands in England. I mean, you know.
Possibly, yes.
If we could support ourselves instead of all the money being in London.
Baz Minister.
We need the Baz Minister. We need his...
Agreed.
The right honourable sound cunt.
Aye.
No, it's like you said, it instills the idea, global democracy and world peace, that all of this was worth the sacrifice for it.
Mm.
As we'll talk about later, at the end of the war, they basically declare world peace.
Yes, and we've had nothing of the sort since.
And what happens is that wars thereafter become peacekeeping missions, essentially.
Yeah.
They become conflicts. They become operations.
Don't forget police actions.
Yeah, police action. Yeah, that's another one. And the justification for those becomes the support and spread of democracy.
Hmm.
Democracy, and especially global democracy, and the defense of global democracy becomes the predication for most, well, if not all, war from the Western side, from, you know, the all the democratic powers justify their wars with democracy.
The democratic axis.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, the democratic axis.
But at the same time, though, these same excuses are used to universalize and further enlarge structures at home. And you no longer choose from the local shops, you choose from the one local supermarket.
Yeah.
You know, as the scale ever gets larger and, you know, we start, you know, it's no longer national corporations anymore, it's multinational corporations. And these require a further layer of management. And ultimately, you as the individual have your ability to meaningfully decide stripped away from you.
Well, you've talked about the entire mythos as well of democracy previously. And it is something really, talking about domestically, that you justify all these changes in people's lives by saying, isn't this wonderful? You start appealing to this internationalist myth in a domestic sense, saying, it's what happens in Britain all the time. Isn't it wonderful that you have all this food from around the world?
Mm.
Isn't it amazing that we have all these global trade routes and, you know, that, you know, your country wouldn't exist without all these foreign relations and foreign powers and immigration? And that, you know, if you are against internationalism, you're against the modern world, which the flip side of it is it makes you incredibly based. But
yeah.
that's like a Chad yes there. But you gain power by appealing to the myth of global democracy, and democracy as this amorphous political concept.
There's almost a kind of point to that, though, that like if only they knew that the modern world is not ideology, it is not progress, it is not, you know, it is not a deliberately structured moral world in a lot of senses. It's just a necessary way of manufacturing society so that people don't actually work out what's happening to them.
Well, there's something as well I've talked about with a lot of the elite theory stuff, is that these people don't know what they're doing a lot of the time. They are consummate pragmatists in many cases, and they don't really care what happens as long as they remain in power because of it. There is not a lot of ideological strength here, as we see with the flipping on Lenin, the flipping on Stalin two ways.
Hmm. Well, I think that might lead us into the next bit of Francis we were going to look at, which sort of plays against this idea of the cynical support of some mission or project or even some sort of idea.
Yes, there's a... It's page, I don't know, it's 132 in the weird PDF we've got.
Yeah, it carries over.
Yeah, and do you want to read this one, Trey? It's the part that starts prior to the 1960s.
I have it right here. Hold on a second. Let me just pop it up on the screen. Right, yeah. Prior to the 1960s, liberal political forces and leaders retained explicit and public commitments to nationalism as Theodore Roosevelt's new nationalism and the chauvinistic and even racist themes in liberal propaganda in World War II, and at least tolerated racial discrimination. Early progressivist intellectual leaders were often educated in, or strongly influenced by, managerial thought in Imperial Germany. And reflected... Yes. And reflected the extreme nationalist, racialist, and statist themes that German thought expressed. Moreover, liberal compromises with nationalism and racism were acts of political convenience based on the political coalition that incorporated nationalistic working class elements and white Southerners, and was necessitated by the lack of an instrument that could inculcate cosmopolitan ideas and overcome contrary beliefs. Such an instrument was available in the form of mass media. Of telecommunications revolution in the 1960s, liberal political forces used to try to re-educate the mass population in cosmopolitan ideology. Through this effort, though this effort has not been very successful, big fucking disagree now, unfortunately, because yes. Boy has that fucking accelerated in the last 20 years, because they thought they had a revolution in telecommunications in the 1960s. Holy shit, well, my friend, the internet has changed things now. Yeah.
To give Francis some credit, the first manuscript of this book is from the early 90s.
Yeah, I know. A lot of this was written in the 90s.
Yeah.
There's a little bit here I'm going to read as well that says, one liberal who did try to re-educate Americans in cosmopolitanism, at least in international affairs, was Woodrow Wilson, whose vision of America's participation in World War One, the Versailles Settlement, and the League of Nations incorporated an explicit appeal to a transnational cosmopolitan ideology. Wilson's vision, of course, was vehemently rejected by the Senate and public opinion. It is likely that liberal political leaders learned from his example, and that their inculcations to cosmopolitan ideologies and policies remained a largely covert agenda until they acquired the power and organization to assert them more overtly and explicitly.
You know, that's so much of what we have discussed, sort of summarized there. You know, not only were these people like Woodrow Wilson key players in the institution of democracy, it is very likely that they consciously knew at the time that it allowed them to manufacture the consent of the governed through essentially playing on whatever myth was trendy at the time.
Yeah, they were able to be pragmatic nationalists until they, you know, essentially could do away with it.
Well, and much the same as you were discussing last week, I believe, The fact that liberal nations, quote unquote, went to the lengths of using very anti-liberal tactics like racist propaganda.
Based.
You know, we are told that we fought World War II for everything that was good and nothing that was bad, but we were also fighting an ethnic war against the eternal German, and that yes. part gets scrubbed out of the propaganda. I mean, I feel like I have an obligation to ask you, have you seen Hitler Lives?
Oh, dear. Well, again, to return to the part of the earlier point, someone put in the chat manufactured deceit. It kind of is. It becomes much more effective when you're able to just manufacture this perception by doing something like a war. And when you do that, you can, you know, in one instant, reframe history to reinforce it, using that traumatic instant as a lens. And all hardship can be justified to promote these, you know, these neo-democratic goals. Because what you're able to do, like what Francis described with the cosmopolitanizing of the masses, is that once you do away with another piece of this old, you know, old way of doing things, even if it is like nationalism, kind of your way of doing things that was brought on by the previous, you know, iteration of your elites, you're able to reframe that as part of the anti-democratic old world. And you are able to reframe what is coming next, you know, even if it promotes hardship, like lockdowns, like we talk about now with all the climate stuff that's happening, you promote that as the real incarnation, the, you know, towards the pure society of you know, distilled democracy. You're able to do this repeatedly, but the biggest accelerating factor, you're able to, you know, jump up by a factor of 10 in an instant by doing something like a war. That's what this does, and that's what he describes. It's the fact that by the time you reach 45, a lot of that resistance isn't shattered, but the pieces are already there that it can be eroded. And by the time you reach the 60s, American society is unrecognizable. in about 20 years.
Mm. Well, this is the great thing, well, great thing slash terrifying thing and horrifying thing about the pragmatism that's ended up in politics. Because, as you say, you don't need an ideology, in fact, because it's just pragmatic and, oh, we'll need a new law for that. Oh, we'll need a new tax for that. Oh, we'll need a new this. It doesn't really matter what party is in. As long as they keep on adding to the state's power, it all builds to a global, certainly a national hegemony and then a global hegemony where it is just a massive totalitarian state that's got there creepingly, slowly by inches, that eventually you have no way out of. And it doesn't matter whether you've got left wing, right wing, middle of the road, whoever, as long as they're all just, oh, well, we'll add a new tax for that. Oh, well, we'll create a new law for X, Y, or Z. It just grows.
The pragmatism is just a consequence of the way society is already structured by the nature of its relationship to both scale and technology.
Yeah.
You know, that predicates that attitude because no other attitude actually fits how society develops and changes because it's entirely amoral.
Well, you end up with people who are products of the system getting in charge of the system.
Mm.
And you can have a lot of boring people who may not be Machiavellian actors.
I don't know if that's necessarily true.
What do you mean?
I would suggest that as much as we have discussed the sort of illusion in democracy, part of that illusion, or the important part of that illusion, is that it's actually roughly the same class of people who are still somewhat in power. It's just that it's slightly more widespread and run by people who, shall we say, don't have the time preference that they used to have back in the day.
I mean as in low-level bureaucrats, right, middle managers. Yeah. You end up with the system being run and caretaked by people who eventually are product of it.
Mm.
Like, you know, we're going to talk next week about the Boomer Truth regime and all that.
Yes.
But a lot of people who are in power now, you know, in power, I put in quotes, as people who are bureaucrats, they're civil servants, they're counselors, they're not necessarily on the bleeding edge, but they are people who are the boring managers. A lot of those people aren't Machiavellians, but they are products of the system and they've got there through the fruits of it.
Yeah.
And all you need is a very small amount of extremely hardcore Machiavellian actors to steer.
Or extreme ideologues.
Yeah, or extreme ideologues to steer a system like that, that is made up of low-level people who believe in its neutrality.
Mm. Well, that, and also as much as they understand the thing as neutral, they then understand that the cause the state outputs must be good.
Yes. You know,
there is an inherent cleansing aspect to the state or the establishment or the institutions associated with the state putting out some sort of narrative, much like, you know, say, for example, the ones we have with our boogeymen or our allies or...
Boogeymen.
Certainly with our mid-level and our propagandists and our telecommunications and so on. But at the top, your top leaders, you know, it's no longer men of character, people who have grown to be liked by those around them and have become, you know, people of power. Not that, that ever really was the case. It's now, you know, that you're groomed into a position of leadership by you know, literally the opposite of that, by people with, you know, wealth and power born through corruption and the destitution of others, essentially. What's his name? Keynesianism. You're Keynesianism crowd. You're, oh, yes, we like to, you know, go and charge around Europe and bed boys, you know, and, oh, by the way, we've got lots of power now and all of the elites are groomed and created by us. Well, the mid levels, fine, yeah, you're right. But the top end, they're scum. The lot of them.
Well, they are. But what I'm saying is that a lot of people who pull the low level levers of power do so not unthinkingly, but often uncritically.
Yes.
Well, I think there's a Hopper quote. I'm not too sure if we used it before, but there's a notion that what democracy allows, and especially sort of democratic bureaucracy and all, you know, these multiple levels of voting and whatever else, you have a population that thinks it simultaneously rules over itself whilst also not being ruled over. You know, as you said, through that neutrality, it thinks that it's free, but ultimately it's playing within you know, a set of
the best example is those people who think, you know, oh, you know, they say to police, oh, you work for me. The people who actually believe that they are at some level the employers of state employees because, you know, they think that the mass of the people literally makes up the state.
Mm.
And they end up with this very, very warped logic about themselves and those around them that gets them quite often into trouble.
They also think their taxes are paying for the system rather than shackles put on them by the system, which is a nice little reframe they've managed.
None of that would be possible without the myths.
No.
Yeah.
They need to absorb these myths as early as possible, really, to be convinced into this project, if you will. I mean, I think if you want to go on to the next section
yes,
of stuff here.
One of the biggest figures we tried to track through World War II, because we did FDR previously, a lot of the FDR stuff is actually pre-World War II, and his World War II actions are really a continuation of that. The zenith of the New Deal is World War II. It is death of stimulus. But the other figure is Churchill. And, you know, we talked about the Churchillian myth last time. But he, in this period, he does... He's the first person, actually, to do this amazing about-face on the USSR and Stalin. He does an act of internationalist amnesia that is so brazen that it actually does get talked about in the historiography of the time. It's one of the only outlying factors that has been allowed to stay in because he didn't do it in lockstep. He maybe did it a year too early.
Well, yeah, it's not quite as soon as the New York Times, and I can't remember the name of the reporter at the moment, writing positive stories and then having the Cold War.
Yes.
It's a bit more tight and concise with his time and his old Churchill.
Yeah, it is. What happened was in 1944, Churchill was talking to Stalin at the Moscow conference, and he came up with something in his own pen. We have evidence of this. Like he basically a fag packet carving up of Europe because he was desperate to keep Stalin in the war.
I do love that idea that they are actually just sitting somewhere in Moscow and like Churchill's literally drawing up Europe in the back of a fucking
cigar case.
Well,
he has to because Stalin is borderline illiterate. He is not a man who can write easily and
he
read.
He can
easily.
Rob a bank, though.
Yeah, that's the point. He is essentially a Ukrainian potato farmer and bank robber.
Is he not Georgian?
He spent a lot of time. He was Georgian. He spent a lot of time in the Ukraine.
Mm.
He spent a lot of time basically bombing around Eastern Europe, and he is not a man of writing. Let's say so. Things have to be explained to him in quite like you would explain to a child.
So, like, Churchill's got this drawn, and he's like, that's your bit if you win. That's
you have this percent of this bit if you win. And basically, what ended up happening was that he drew up an agreement that he would basically have large amounts of influence over most of Europe. He just puts the others 25%. So he basically cedes 25% influence, in his words, to Russia for the whole of Europe. I think he basically puts on like 0% for Greece because the UK wants Greece. but he's sat here selling out large parts of Eastern Europe in 1944 to Stalin as an incentive for him to stay in the war. Because Kurt Churchill is the consummate toady. He is the man that stands behind other people and tells them to, like, yeah, get them, boys. That's what he was as, you know, Lord of the Admiralty. That's what he did during his ill-fated expeditions everywhere that seemed to have made him fail upwards. But this is what he's doing in 44 with Stalin. The percentages agreement and the what became known as the spheres of influence directly came from Churchill. He did it behind the back of the other allies as well.
He made him our guy for as little as possible.
Yes, he did. Again, this was him selling Europe to Joseph Stalin. And yet we see him... this isn't even a full 2 years later. This is like 18 months later in 1946. This is October 44 to March 46. It's not two whole years. And what he does is, in 1946, in Fulton, Missouri, he delivers the famous Iron Curtain speech. 18 months after essentially selling Europe to Stalin while the war was still going on. I don't know. Do you want to do your bad Churchill impression, Trig?
I can if you like. Go on, don't worry.
I put it in the document. It's from Setting in the Baltic. It's that famous bit there.
You know, let's just clear this off so I can bring up the document without it. But let's go for it. Let's go for it. From Setting in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind the line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of the Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. And all are subject in one form or another, not only to the Soviet influence, but to a very high and, in many cases, increasing measure of control from Moscow.
Gee,
what a switcheroo to pull on him. Like, here, Mr. Joe, you've been a big help doing the Germans this last push. You know, we've decided that despite the fact that we don't really have any right to, we're going to hand you most of Eastern Europe. And if you come to Berlin, we're no really game for a fight because we were tuckered out anyway.
Yeah.
And then, you know, only what? That must be 10 months after the war finishes, VE Day?
Yes.
To turn around and be like, bad Stalin, you stole that and it's all under your control. Even though we said you could do it, you're bad for doing that.
Well, it's something we'll talk about in the next episode because we've yet to do the time period of 45 to 50 properly. But Churchill has just lost an election. And he just lost an election because the people bought into this collectivist stuff he'd been pushing. And they essentially didn't. They thought already in 45 he was spoiling for a fight with the Russians. And they were tired. They didn't want that. They were essentially, they were like, the agitation phase is over, please. Can we have the consolidation phase?
Yeah, give us the integration.
Yeah, I don't want any more agitation. Integrate me, please. but what happens is that he is this figure in 46 who's seen as on the margins. The Americans don't like him doing this, especially on their soil. He's seen as a troublemaker, a rabble rouser. Because what's happening in the background is that, you know, the remnants of the Roosevelt era and the remnants of the Roosevelt cabinet are desperately trying to bring Uncle Joe back on side.
Well, yeah, because it's very clearly it's a win-win no matter what happens.
Yes.
Either they give Stalin backhanders and he becomes one of the new, you know, elites to roll around as part of global democracy, and he gets all the new fancy tech, and he gets to be a good guy whether he's a dictator or not, really.
Mm.
And if he doesn't want to do that, they just turn him into a boogeyman and fight a fake war and get elected on that too.
It's the issue with like the Truman era stuff, and that you end up with this slow transformation where they realize they have to turn Stalin into this boogeyman. You know, they have to switch his friend-enemy distinction from friend to enemy, as we talked about last time a little bit. But they do this quite slowly, and it's when I studied this era actually in great detail. I did like a pre-degree course for history when I was doing my A-levels, and this is one of the pivotal things that we studied, and there's a great mystery here, because from the Western point of view, it is Stalin who is making a lot of these moves. I mean, yes, he'd been misled essentially by Winston Churchill, but what the US wanted was, they just wanted him to play ball more with the global, you know, the global homo stuff. They wanted him to play ball more with the UN and play ball more with globalism.
Well, it's, you know, think who Churchill was. He was probably around the turn, what age would it have been, around 46? It'd have been his 60s yet.
I think he was in his 60s, yeah.
Yeah. So you're looking at a man who was educated in the 1880s and the 1890s.
Yeah, he went gallivanting around.
The prime of the late Victorian era, the last dying vestiges of Britannia ruling the world. And this is him having his crack at it.
It is, yes. It's him desperately trying to hang on to some British power and relevance through the conduit of other countries.
I mean,
yet he ends up completely destroyed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he did the unthinkable. For me, one of the worst things is he gave jet engines to the Russians. He literally put Rolls-Royce jet engines into MiG-15s, and then very soon America would be flying up against them in the Korean War, going, where the hell did all these Russian jet engines come from? Oh, these look remarkably like Rolls-Royce jet engines. What the hell, Churchill?
Well, also what happens in the late 40s, as we'll get to, is that there is a very lax amount of security around the atomic secrets, let's say.
Oh, God.
In that four of the scientists who are allowed to work on it, who had unrestricted access to the files, were extremely hardcore Jewish communists. And these people, you know, leaked the atomic secrets and to some degree assisted the Soviets in developing their program. And it is a very odd point of history that this was essentially allowed to happen.
Well, yeah, you've also got, you know, who were the only other people really working on nuclear programs at the time?
Yeah.
Ex-Nazis. So, it's almost, I don't think you'd be totally out of the limbs to say that these people were probably working with each other.
Yeah.
There's a great degree, actually, of cooperation, especially after the Stalin era, between the US and the Soviet Union, that people don't talk about. How open the lines of communications were after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and how post-Vietnam there was so much essentially play fighting going on, and that this relationship with Stalin was more of a souring of a hegemony than it was a, you know, what we are told about the forming of the Cold War, that Joseph Stalin was very aggressive and he did push boundaries and he did really try to make a stamp on East Germany, especially, which he wasn't supposed to do. He wasn't supposed to get that. And the reaction, like I said, from the Western powers and America especially, is just it's placation. And it's only placation. A lot of people talk about war reticency, but I don't think that's true. They were really expecting him to come and play ball with them.
Mm.
They really just thought that he would come and be the other pillar to their big global project. But you're right, either way they win. Either they get this massive amount of global hegemony with Stalin essentially becoming their lapdog, or they're able to reframe him as the enemy of democracy and create the Cold War.
Well, that's you know, as you use the terms friends and enemy, that will come up more importantly, but narratively, you know, think of them as the perfect form of the hero, you know, the democratic hero and the dictatorial villain, that you have to ignore the fact that he uses the democracy and the consent of the governed as his justification for what he's doing. I mean, it's again, it's playing on the mythos, and that these figures, like, you know, Lenin and Stalin, despite the fact that they were the bad guys, were useful pawns in deposing the Tsar.
Yes.
Hitler and Wilhelm weren't people that they were particularly interested in helping, but it was useful to agitate them in a war over Germany to get rid of the last, you know, your Hohenzollerns and Habsburgs and all these people who would have otherwise possibly been people that would have come into the realms of power in these regions. Same against the British monarchy.
Well, really, up until the invasion of Czechoslovakia, Hitler was still very much our guy. Again, He was seen as a man of the... We talked about this. He was seen as a man of the modern age. He was extolled by people like Lloyd George. He was really seen as one of these great modern democratic leaders, and he saw himself as a democrat. And then that image is projected onto German people post-war, as we'll get into with a lot of the denazification next time. The German people are considered as impure for voting for and allowing the rule of Hitler.
Yeah, there's possibly a connection that we'd need to delve in deeper and possibly even go to the realms of doing like a full look at the Frankfurt School, because they are to blame for some of this thought that we replace the divine rule of kings via God with the divine rule of the masses.
Yes.
And the collective consciousness of man, as opposed to the singular consciousness of God, now becomes the highest thing that you can appeal to.
Well,
and of course, that's, you know, it's so utilitarian. And
it's nightmarish. It's nightmarish. I mean, I'm a bit of a czarist. I literally, honestly believe that the getting rid of the czars and all of that lot, worst thing that's happened to Russia in hundreds of years. And they were if the czars had remained in power in Russia, Russia would have been ahead of America in terms of technology, and they would have had people like Like Tesla potentially going to Russia rather than America.
Is that necessarily a good thing, them having more advanced technology, given where you know where some of the parts of this series are going?
Well, the issue is that it may have become at least a balancing factor.
Yeah.
It's the most important aspect, which was the Tsar was sovereign from all this globalist muck.
Yes.
He would have had zero interest whatsoever because, you know, even the mass and scale stuff affects the minds of our leaders. If our leaders are too busy concerned about what's happening in Iraq, how are they going to sort what's going on here? You know, the Tsar didn't give a shit about what was happening in Europe for a lot of his stuff past what affected him trade-wise because he was too busy with Russia.
Yeah.
Well, it's what you
and he cared about
put down in the notes here is the democratic revolution, which is, again, it's the parallel to the, when we talk about the managerial revolution, it is really the part of that. It's the democratic revolution and the managerial revolution going on hand in hand at this time, facilitating each other and feeding off each other as well.
Well, it's part of the sort of mass and scale stuff. You know, if you're going to have a larger society with more people involved in bigger systems, then democracy kind of just makes sense as the likely outcome from that.
Well, you are correct about the mythos, though, again, that the myth of the sacrifice of World War II, it ends up replacing a lot of the monarchs and the last vestiges of properly organized religious institutions across Europe that are present in people's everyday lives. Anyway, it's the divine right of kings replaced by the divine rule of the masses. It's pure, again, Hegel, Bentham. It's all the stuff we talked about in episode one.
Shall we go on? Because there's quite a nice, concise book, Schmidt.
Yeah. And there's now, there's a higher order to appeal to. And you can read the quote here. This is the quote from Carl Schmitt, The Sovereign Collection. This is page 90 from an essay called Concept of the Political. And this stuff is basically impossible to find online.
Yeah, so. I've managed to find one company, Antelope Hill, that does a publishing of it. And otherwise, you have to pay for original prints or bad reprints. However, it is very much worth looking into. But he goes on to say that the idea of a League of Nations was clear and precise as long as a League of Nations could be held up as a polemical antithesis to a League of Princes. Again, it's right there, really, isn't it? This is how the German word Volkerbund, literally League of Peoples, came into being in the 18th century. With the political significance of the monarchy, this polemical meaning ceased to exist. A League of Nations could moreover be the ideological instrument of imperialism of a state, or a coalition of states directed against other states. In that case, everything that was said earlier about the political use of the word humanity would apply to it. Moreover, the foundation of a League of Nations embracing the whole of humanity could ultimately correspond to hitherto only vague tendency to organise an apolitical, idealised state of the universal society of humanity. Therefore, almost always quite uncritically, it is claimed that such a League of Nations should become universal, i.e. that all states on Earth must become its members. Universality, however, would first and foremost have to mean complete depoliticisation, and thus, at the very least, the systematic dissolution of states. You know, he's sort of very concisely making a number of very sort of red-pilled points there about how, you know, that's this myth that we've been discussing, this universalizing process, is one of the best processes to appeal to if you want power and if you want to engage in imperial sort of action. And it is predicated on, you know, the Volkerbund, the League of Peoples, thinking of the nation above the individual or above the prince.
Yeah, it's this idea of, he talks about depoliticization, which is, again, I think he's also hinting at the supposed neutrality of institutions there.
No, he is entirely suggesting that you become part of the grander neutral state as opposed to your non-neutral political state.
It's a great way of describing it because it shows what happens to people who aren't subsumed in the system within the country and that they end up becoming, you know, they have to be depoliticized or else they're imprisoned, essentially. And that would have to happen on a international scale, if there was truly to be a League of Humanity. What he's talking about essentially here in very good language is that to have global governance, especially global democracy, you have to have extreme global hegemony. So I don't know, there's a reason that people don't want to read Schmitt.
Well, no, he's very clearly discussing what we mentioned earlier on, though, that these things all go hand in hand, and that it would be very difficult to see this stuff as happening in the world without at least first considering at some point that maybe, just maybe, this was done deliberately.
Yes.
And that people knew what they were up to. You know, they essentially either were stupid enough to think that by becoming part of the globalist project, their nation would be supreme, or that they totally, as we suggested, ideologically committed themselves to the global project.
It's the point about universality as well with the League of Nations. It shows that the United Nations is this real attempt at that. Is this real attempt to depoliticize and really identity of all the nations within it as they become, you know, more and more bound to its wishes.
It will be the entity that decides whether or not you are universalized yet.
Yeah. Yes.
To go back to what you just said there, Evelyn, with regards, there is a third one, as I mentioned this before, is if everybody else is doing it, you've got to also join in, just in case you get left out of it.
A lot of FOMO, yeah.
There's that one too.
Yeah, otherwise you end up being North Korea, and then, you know, everyone starves.
But, you know, this League of Nations, it needs a League of Enemies, it needs a League of Villains.
Oh, that would be based. I mean, they are the League of Villains, though, that's the whole thing.
No, that's the irony, but, you know, they create these figures, like, you know, they essentially create Hitler out of the midst of, essentially, you know, a turmoilous kind of Germany that is their fault anyway.
Yep.
And then they use him to slander and, you know, suggest that he acted in the same absolutist fashion that prior kings did.
Yep.
To, you know, further muddy the myth, despite the fact that they've kind of already destroyed it whilst playing upon it, some of its tones.
Again, this the universal democratic mythos, it needs the hero figures like we talked about, Churchill, FDR, Lloyd George in World War One, Woodrow Wilson, and if you're of a certain bent, Lenin and Stalin. And it also needs its counterpart villains, like you said, Hitler, Mussolini, Tojo, the Kaiser, and once again Stalin, who is... You know, he's Schrodinger's hero and villain. He actually serves both roles simultaneously to many people.
He was a massive bastard. I mean, it has to be said. You only have to look at Kulaks and the Holodomor and etc. and you go, Stalin, bit of a cunt. Excuse me, but, you know.
But without peacekeepers in every home, what happens is that global democracy exists in people's minds.
Mm.
It doesn't exist in their everyday lives yet. But the mythos of it, especially, is, you know, very powerful in a world that's just been traumatized by war.
The axis of supervillains these days is a bit weak, isn't it? The axis of evil is, you know, Iraq. Oh, that was scary. Oh,
it's like this is George Orwell talks in 1984 about the 2-minute hate.
Yeah,
you know, it's about giving you an enemy because simultaneously this makes you understand who your friends are. And that either, you know, your friends are democratic, but those people over there, they're evil because they're undemocratic.
Yeah, it's...
And this essentially allows you to get away with whatever you want.
Well, the problem is what's happened now is you ended up with... It's a great example that you end up with a Bush era. You end up with he talks about the axis of evil. Again, that he invents.
Don't you mean the axle of Elvis?
Yeah, the axle of Elvis, where he brings, you know, he staples North Korea to Iraq. Like, yeah. These people, like, these countries have anything to do with each other. Like, these countries could even understand each other in many ways.
Yeah, we need to go to Mogadishu because the Chinese have got something to do with it.
It's the same thing we talked about last time with the Axis in World War II being essentially a piece of propaganda. They had treaties and they had agreements, but they never had joint offensives. They never cooperated to the degree that we're led to believe. They were never really partners in the war. They were only allies of convenience at most and had, you know, non-aggression pacts at the least. It's a great way to sell people a myth.
So what you're saying is it's okay to nuke Japanese folk because they were friends with the Nazis and ergo our enemy.
Yes. Again, it's all... Once you start seeing it as friend-enemy distinction everywhere, it becomes very... That's what... That's like we'll talk about later. That's all politics really is. It is saying, I am your friend and my enemies are your enemies and I will smite your enemies because I am your friend.
And what they never say is the fact that if my enemies aren't your enemies, you are not my friend. That's the implicit bit. That's the threat that they every once in a while make a little mask off thing about. Well,
again, once I talked, like I talked about earlier, the figures, the elites and the heroes of a previous age are reframed as autocrats and villains and racists because of their lack of democratic thinking. And their lack of democracy demonstrates their lack of virtue. People no longer venerate as much figures like Queen Victoria, who was borderline worshipped at the end of her era, as, you know, this sovereign of the empire, Empress of India. Everybody had pictures of her, you know, not because there was a law, because there was mass deference and mass love for the royal family in that age.
Yeah.
And now she's seen as kind of an austere, almost silly figure. And, you know, the royals and the empire builders of that time are now seen as dangerous, anti-democratic autocrats, whereas in their day, they were the heroes of this Hegelian internationalist world building. They were really how we would see the globalists. They were civilizing Africa. They were cutting down the jungle and, you know, bringing schools. These men were heroes in their day, and no one would disagree with you in that. Now they are the anti-democratic, you know, racist autocrats of old.
I mean, you're so right on that. I mean, Victoria and Albert, who were, I mean, as you say, venerated and, you know, not worshipped as such, but yes, certainly very, very highly regarded and respected. Now, as you said, Victoria, austere, stern-looking character, and Prince Albert, named after a cock ring, or vice versa, which I don't know whether that's actually true or not, but apparently that's where it came from. And they've made a mockery of it.
That's what they were attempting to do, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
The you know, to use a phrase that gets used, but I think people don't understand enough, is they set a year zero, especially, you know, at 1945, whereby Churchill, FDR, these people are heroes. You know, these people will be cemented in history, and as long as these people who currently control the hegemony post-war can continue to do so, then they can enshrine their myth of this whole era as the framework for God knows how many ever years afterwards.
Well, what happens is that democracy itself, through this, again, through establishing a year zero, becomes a purifying force for the previous age. And all the heinous actions that took place, we talked about during World War II, are purified because they were in pursuit of this new age. And prior to this year zero, everything that happened was to bring you there. In a very deterministic, again, Hegelian sense, that everything that happened happened and couldn't have happened any other way. Otherwise, you wouldn't end up with a modern world. And it was meant to be like that. And you are now in this new, wonderful age of world peace, because all these heinous things were done, but all these heinous things were done to bring you global democracy. And through that, well, democracy starts to take on its own, I think you put this in the notes, but its own friend-enemy distinction.
Yeah, well, it's a truth regime.
Yes.
It's a regime that tells you that these are the good and true things and these are the wrong and lying, deceitful things. And that it does that by, again, playing on this notion that the consensus is behind us and agreeing that these people are our friends and that those people are our enemies. And that boils down to even some of the most insignificant, what you would think are neutral factors in your daily life. Like just being a part of the national project of war. I mean, we've got quite a nice bit from Mises here that's a bit kind of more conceptual and might not make as much sense in regards to what we're discussing at the moment, but I don't know if you want to do this one or not.
I can't say that word.
Volkswirtschaft, I believe.
Volkswirtschaft. Okay, there's a quote here from Mises, which I think this makes a lot of sense. I quite like this.
It's just that if you need to really be following us to see where we're going with this, but the each individual part of the managerial society gets you that little bit closer to believing in it. Just performatively playing a part in such, you know, as I said, what may seem like a, say, for example, an economic and neutral front. If it is towards some greater project, then, you know, maybe it's not quite as neutral as it would seem on the grand scale.
Yeah, it's the Volkswirtschaft. It's a German word. It's a German concept, really, as most of this is. You know, there's what was that film we watched with Ryan Gosling in it?
True Believer.
True Believer. Yeah, in True Believer, Ryan Gosling says that the modern world is a Jewish disease. But through this, we see that the modern world is actually a German disease.
No, that's the postmodern world.
The modern world is a German disease, anyway. As Mises will describe here. The market economy, as such, does not respect political frontiers. Its field is the world. The term Volkswirtschaft, I'm going to abridge it like that, was long applied by the German champions of government omnipotence. Only much later, the British and the French began to speak of the British economy, and basically the French economy, as distinct from the economics of other nations. But neither the English nor the French language produced an equivalent term of Volkswirtschaft, with the modern trend towards national planning and national autarky, is that?
Autarky. As autarky, in that's it. The sort of notion that you can have your nation be self-supporting in a certain sense, but in a cynical nature, in this way that, you know, Trump's like, oh, steel tariffs, that kind of thing.
The doctrine involved in this German world became popular everywhere. Nonetheless, only the German language is able to express it in one word, all the ideas implied. The Volkswirtschaft is a sovereign nation's total complex of economic activities directed and controlled by the government. It is socialism realized within the political frontiers of each nation. In employing the term, people are fully aware of the fact that the real conditions differ from the state of affairs which they deem the only adequate and desirable state, but they judge everything that happens in the market economy from the point of view of their idea. They assume that there is an irreconcilable conflict between the interests of the Volkswirtschaft and those of the selfish individuals eager to seek profit. It's about national interest, GDP, and the idea of a national economy as a consequence of policy, rather than just the aggregate, transactions between free thinking, free acting individuals. It is this, he's describing kind of the mind virus of GDP.
It's so metaphysical, though, on a certain level, that, he's suggesting that man only becomes aware of himself in this state as something that does not help towards it. And that the system in and of itself supposedly has its own values, and that these are the only neutral values. I mean, I don't know how far on through this quote we want to go, because there's some further good bits toward the second part of the paragraph as well, I believe.
The German language is slightly prone to doing this sort of thing with compound words as well, because they even get it even longer with Volkswirtschaft, Lich, at the end, at the bottom there, where it's, basically, let's stick life at the end of it. And just keep on putting extra words into one big word. They can,
It's going over the same point again. It's like, what's the other German phrase? Whatever that one is there, that I can't say that's four words, but in brackets, the welfare of the nation takes precedence over the selfishness of the individual.
Is he quoting Spock there? Is he actually saying the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few?
An incredibly value-laden statement.
Yeah.
Whatever get vor eigennutz or whatever. I'm presuming that's some sort of German way of basing you're a selfish bastard.
Yeah.
But he suggests that, this was the fundamental principle of Nazi economic management. It was the fundamental principle of the New Deal as well. But as people are too dull and too vicious to comply with this rule, it is the task of government to enforce it. The German princes of the 17th and 18th century, foremost among the Hohenzollern and electors of Brandenburg and kings of Prussia, were fully equal to this task. In the 19th century, even in Germany, the liberal ideologies imported from the West superseded the well-tried and natural policies of nationalism and socialism. However, Bismarck and his successors, Sozialpolitik, and finally Nazism, restored them. Which he's essentially suggesting is there is, it's serfdom writ large on a scale that actually requires more tyranny in your life than there would have been during actual serfdom as we understand it.
Yeah, it's the national interest. And it's the national interest economically he's talking about. And this idea that prior to people thinking of themselves in these terms, a medieval peasant wouldn't think about the British economy.
Mm.
He might think about, the purse of the king. He might think about, the treasures that the lords have or the baron class has, but he'd never think about the national economy.
Well,
it's ridiculousness to think so, but this is a mindset that is a product of modernity.
Hmm.
and we can't think outside of it. There was a time very recently before people, when people did not think about the national economy. They had no concept of it. Even during the Industrial Revolution in Britain, the early Industrial Revolution especially, people didn't have an idea of, you know, the British economy. They didn't think of it in those terms at all. They thought about industrialists and companies, and, you know, sometimes they talk about exports and colonies and foreign affairs.
But in terms of their own interests.
Yeah, in terms of their own interests, not the national interest. It's a very recent, it's a very 20th century concept. But it does have its roots in a lot of the German idealism he talks about previously.
Well, that's that even that goes back the right through all the Kuhnelt Laden stuff we're looking at too.
Yes,
you know, Protestant universalism and you know all the sort of idea that all men are equal under God and therefore we all serve equally, and you know this just carries all the way through to the point where you have supranational organizations declaring, or, you know, world peace. You know, they are making the, I think, to play back on a bit of Schmitt that we haven't quite got here, but the main thing he's understood for is the phrase, the sovereign is he who makes the exception.
Yes.
And on a small scale, if you are part of an economic system whereby you make no decision in regards to your part of the production process, you make no exceptions because you can't do so. If you are the prince of a region or the leader of even a nation, and the UN decides that world peace has been declared, who are you to say otherwise? It's not your ability to decide. Here's, so sovereignty on all those levels is just attacked.
Here's a very important point. Individual countries declared war separately, generally, during World War II. There were some, you know, mass
declarations. There was at least the illusion.
Yeah, there was the illusion that the British declared war and the Germans declared war. The declaration of war was done by countries, but the declaration of peace was done by a supranational force. Imagine how powerful the Western democratic hegemony had to be able to declare, basically all at once on VE Day, that they had won world peace. That is an amazing demonstration of power, that they went into these wars as countries and left it as, you know, the West, that even our concept of the West is tied.
It's predicated on the regions of people who, quote unquote, won World War II.
Yes, it is, and it's to do with the fact that it is an immense act of collectivist.
This
power.
Is the reason why, unironically, Russia is seen as part of the West, but Eastern Europe isn't.
Yes,
because Russia was up until 1946 our guy and won in World War II, and ergo they became part of the Western myth and the Western canon.
It's a strange thing to think about because people need to separate themselves from history, really. But you need to be able to realize the power of what they achieved when they were able to come out of this war as a collective, as essentially they'd become an internationalized version of all the coalition governments that happened between the wars in Britain. They were able to come out of this as a supranational military force that had the power, or at least claimed to have the power, to declare war and declare peace on a global scale. It's quite amazing. We do here have another quote from Hopper's The Great Fiction, which ties in very, very heavily to the ideas we're talking about here. I don't know, Triggs, you want to read this one?
Yeah, can do. Give me a second. Where does it start?
It's page 110, and it starts with The Logic of the State. Again, this is Hans Hermann Hoppe's Great Fiction.
Let me just find the logic of... I've got this...
It's page 126, I think, in the PDF, if people are reading along at home, which I know a few people do, you absolute madmen.
These are the people I respect. If you're doing your homework, then good. Because your homework for next week is to look up truth regimes and Foucault.
It's again. I wanna get to Foucault. It's page 126 in the PDF, Trig. I wanna get to Foucault because Foucault is a great example. As I always talk about, he's like a case study of the uselessness of the left.
Mm.
He's a man who realized so many things and touched on so many things.
Oh no, I think we might have a lost Trig.
Oh. No, you haven't lost me. I've just I missed the. the speech marks in around logic and lost the page.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Like I said, Foucault is somebody who was able to touch on a few aspects. He talks about the panopticon as a psychological and kind of sociological construct, reviving it essentially from the obscurity of history and reappropriating kind of the Benthamite problems with liberalism. And then he's able to go into truth regimes and talk about these things with relative power and ease. And then he becomes a socialist, a basic bitch socialist. Goes around noncing boys and dies of AIDS.
Yes, get to Foucault before Foucault gets to your kids. Love it. Love it. Love that comment in chat.
Yeah. Well said. The thing is, that's what all the left can do, really, post-war especially, is this idea of the criticizer. It is the criticizer.
Mm.
But it is on rails, and it has already forged the world it wants to have. Yeah. And there's no better example of that as someone like Foucault, who essentially... is just saying empty words because he has no real metaphysics to back it up, and he has no real.
Some of his analysis of it is quite good, but that's maybe a subject for a later time.
It is, yes, but he was able to do nothing with it. Mm. It is unactualized analysis. It is an analysis, not a logical conclusion.
Anyway,
depends how you read it.
Oh yeah, you can read it and make your own logical conclusions. But the issue is that he didn't. He went off and became a member of the mainstream French Socialist Party. And if that's the conclusions you draw when you read that, you are not someone who is capable of proper reasoned thought.
Yeah, I think actually it might be worth starting this from the line or the paragraph above the short one, because I think that quite nicely and succinctly talks about what we've been discussing.
In light of the unpopularity of this policy.
Yeah,
okay.
He's talking about mass immigration.
Yeah,
that's the policy.
But I think if we're to look at it in a terms of sort of a more general sense, because he's talking about a large scale process here. I just
the top of the page, Greg.
Yeah. In light of the unpopularity of this policy, one might wonder about the motive for engaging in it. However, given the nature of the state, it is not difficult to discover a rationale. States, as will be recalled, are also promoters of forced domestic integration. Forced integration is a means of breaking up all intermediate social institutions and hierarchies in between the state and the individual, such as family, clan, tribe, community, football team, church, and their internal layers and ranks of authority. Through forced integration, individuals are isolated, atomized, and their power of resistance vis-à-vis the state is weakened. In the logic of the state...
That's a very Leviathan and its enemies point.
Before we go on to that next paragraph, I think it just needs to be restated that, think of what the process he's describing there. And then think of, your local community is ultimately mostly made up of men in your community who take their own time to go and do physical things.
Yeah.
Okay, you send half of them off to war and only a quarter of them come back.
Yeah.
All these intermediate institutions and this complex hierarchy of family, clan, tribe, community, and church, it's all destroyed. There's none of it left.
Oh, yeah.
And everyone's replaced with a psychosis of going to war.
And then you go and bring in some Afghanis who've helped you in the war, or whatever, whoever has helped you in that war, and bring them in to replace that area, and then you end up with Rotherham and all sorts of other horrifying messes.
Well, that part comes later, but yes,
it's a few steps down the line, but it is essentially, because we're talking about mass immigration here, aren't we?
Yes, this chapter is on a wider point, but it's, his discussion of the motives of why you would want to do this.
Yes.
And these motives are the sort of general motives of state actors, if you will.
He goes on to say about the logic of the state. In the logic of the state, a hefty dose of foreign invasion, especially if it comes from strange and faraway places, is reckoned to further strengthen this tendency. And the present situation offers a particularly opportune time to do so. For in accordance with the inherently centralizing tendency of states and statism, generally and promoted here, now in particular the US as the world's only remaining superpower, the Western world, or more precisely the neoconservative social democrat, neoconservative social democratic elites controlling the state governments in the US and Western Europe, is committed to the establishment of supranational states, such as the European Union, and ultimately one world state. National, regional, or communal attachments are the main stumbling blocks on the way to this goal. A good measure of uninvited foreigners and government-imposed multiculturalism is calculated to further weaken and ultimately destroy national, regional, and communal identities, and thus promote the goal of a one-world order led by the US and a new universal man, which is Hegel's new man.
Yeah.
Except
this time he's mulatto.
Yeah, it's Hegel's mulatto new man. Mm. It's the CBC putting out material talking about a grand beige horizon.
We're also getting towards Fukuyama.
Maybe is that what Hegel
Fukuyama
was discussing the whole time? Is the destruction of the white man and replacement with the global 56%.
He wasn't talking about new man, he was talking about new male.
We're also
very rapidly heading towards Fukuyama's end of history and the last man as well at this point.
I don't know if I buy that, but yeah.
No, I don't. I think Fukuyama was another utopianist idiot.
If I remember correctly, both in Great Fiction and in Leviathan and Its Enemies, there is actually a response to Fukuyama, essentially suggesting that even if he's right in terms of describing the process that social liberalism leads to, he's completely wrong in diagnosing what you should do because of that.
Oh, he is totally wrong on so many fronts. To get to Fukuyama's end of history, you would need just such massive carnage to get the whole world to a single, sort of basically social state. You're literally talking beige man, everyone looks the same, everyone speaks the same, and a dollar buys you, a loaf of bread in every country. There is no stock exchange because it's all the same. Nightmare. And it doesn't work. It's totally fucking mental. The idea that, a kilo of lithium in Chile is going to cost you the same amount as a kilo of lithium in England, where one, you literally dig it out of the ground and one place you have to import it.
It's almost nonsense. The logic is that they are solving the calculation problem by completely destroying all human culture variety.
It's so much easier to get you to invest in an internationalist project if you can only seek meaning through that avenue. If you can't seek meaning through community or church or anything locally around you, then you must seek meaning by something extraneously from that, and that's why they need these narratives. They need to create enemies, they need to create good, they need to create bad in the world, at least as they see it. I mean, maybe it's not quite to get to the realms of suggesting that man can't understand good and evil without God, but he was much better off understanding good and evil through God than he was through the narratives of the propagandist media conglomerates and war propaganda involved in the 40s and 50s, or sorry, 30s and 40s.
When it comes to war, this is the logic that predicates the idea of, again, it's the ethics of supranational force. It's the idea that if we are heading towards a one world order, and we need to head towards a one world order, for humanity to survive, that you have to recontextualize the conflicts of the past through that. The peace imposition of Versailles was only seen as, it was only seen as harsh in retrospect. It has been rewritten to be the cause of the Second World War in a world that we know the Second World War happened.
But at the time, everyone was, those ruddy Germans.
Yeah. A lot of those people thought the Germans got off too easily. And a lot of people were a little bit upset about Woodrow Wilson redrawing the borders of Europe, but they ultimately thought that maybe we should give this democracy thing a try. Versailles was not seen as a failure state, outside of a retrospect, but we've never reached that re-examination. There's never had to be a re-examination of the peace imposition at the end of World War II. Really, what Hopper's talking about here is that this ends up dissolving basically everything you have before. And 1945 is not a year zero. They did not dissolve all community, all religion, all family, all institutions. It's what they want it to be. And it's kind of the point where they say, right, we have enough power to start slowly doing that. We have enough power to start through the post-war consensus of the West to start completely destroying every you know, a barrier you have between you and direct rule by these state managerialists.
Well, they use that as perfect excuse for future actions, as you will go into, or as we will go into some of the later series. The treatment of Germany post-World War II was horrendous.
Yeah.
The same with, you know, the way that Japan was glassed in large parts. Was only, they only ever got away with it because they both were, at the time, and continued to be for a very long time after that, the enemy as opposed to the friend.
There was a remaking of Germany into a new state, but the idea that you would consider, you know, the fair treatment of Nazi Germany and the fair treatment of Imperial Japan is completely outside the realms of mainstream political thought.
That made you the enemy itself.
Yeah, it did. If you essentially have sympathy for the devil there, you're saying, you know, what about all these German people who, you know, are just ordinary Germans, most of which will have been, to some degree, apolitical. You know, not everybody takes part in all these auspices of the state. That's what this whole total state thing lies to you about. The state is not the collective will of the people. And yet the peace imposition at the end of World War II treated the German and Japanese populace as directly that. And we don't question that because we are told that these people, through their subsummation into the total states of Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany, the people themselves are your enemy. And what you do to them is just because they are your enemy.
Mm. No, it's the, you know, we collectivize the non-democratic enemies into a group that allows us to do with them as we please. And the psychological damage that was done to them, not, you know, because their leaders surrendered, but they were sort of told as a people to surrender.
Yes. It's, again, it's what we talked about last time with the historical oddity of unconditional surrender of an entire populace. That is something that was seen throughout history as what a tyrant, you know, a tyrannical king would not do that. In, you know, in prehistory, they would be seen as a monster, a butcher.
Mm.
They'd be seen as a almost demonic figure for saying that an entire populace itself needs to surrender rather than, you know, making a lord have some quarter. The idea, again, of wars not between ruling classes, not between elites, but between whole peoples is what led us here. And that is impossible without democracy.
Mm.
You can't have that mindset. You can't talk about the people in that way without the mass psychology of democracy.
Well, it is actually an attempt at collective consciousness.
Yeah.
Whether, you know, you'd agree with it or not, it exists out there as the thing that is in people's heads.
It allows all of this to happen. It allows this, again, right now, if you tried to talk to the normal person on the street about the ethical treatment of Nazis, you'd end up, you know, essentially being called one. You're not allowed to be able to recontextualize what happened in World War II without most people having their brain short circuit screeching 1940s propaganda at you.
And yet the crazy thing is the Japanese, who did some really fucking terrible things during their war with China, that's all largely forgotten.
And nobody... In the UK, yes, but in America, right up until the 80s, there was a huge amount of anti-Japanese sentiment.
Well, yeah. I mean, they had to justify dropping the bomb on them, so...
Well, no, there is a grander sort of point here, though, that all sort of political action, especially in a democratic state, is underwritten by framing a conflict before you can even really view your enemy. You know, there's, again, to go into more Schmidt here, I believe this is from page 64. I'm not sure if it's from the same essay as the previous
one. It's page 64 of the book that you've got, which is The Sovereign Collection.
Yes.
That you'll find that, I think that's in the document there, Trigg. We've still got the screenshots of that.
Already got it on screen.
Yeah, it's the first one of those.
The possibility of correct knowledge and understanding, and thus also the power to speak and judge, is only given here through existential participation. Only the participants in an extreme case of conflict can identify it. That is, each of them can only decide for themselves whether the otherness of the stranger in the concrete case of conflict means the negation of their own form of existence, and whether he must therefore be repulsed or fought off in order to preserve their own way of life in accordance with their being. In psychological reality, the enemy is easily treated as evil and ugly because every distinction and grouping, especially the political, as it is the strongest and most intense, draws on all other usable distinctions for support. This does not change the independence of such distinctions. Consequently, the reverse is also true. Need not be the enemy that which is morally, that which is morally evil, aesthetically ugly, or economically harmful. Need not be the enemy. That which is morally good, aesthetically beautiful, and economically useful is not necessarily the friend in the specific, i.e., political sense of the word. Thus, the objectivity and independence of the political is evident in this possibility of separating the friend-enemy distinction from other distinctions and of conceiving it as something independent. So that, you know, there is the mainstream psychology of the friends and enemies that you're told to have or fight against, and that these actually relate in no way to anything that one would refer to as, you know, his number of characteristics, people who are morally evil but we are told to be friends with, things that are aesthetically ugly like brutalism that we are told to live with, or, you know, economic nationalism of the Volkswirtschaft sort of style that is horrendously inefficient and takes no one else's understanding of value in account is the way to go, comrade.
Well, it's the modern example, really, is the political union of, you know, essentially Marxist feminists and conservative Islamists under the auspices of the modern Labour Party.
Yeah.
That is an extremely odd friend-enemy distinction. But in the purely political sense, they see each other as friends.
It's a genius manoeuvre.
It is a genius manoeuvre. It's a great example of when Schmidt talks about the political, and that the political really is just a series of, you know, increasingly in many cases absurd friend-enemy distinctions. That's, you know, I think that's partly why you called the blog that we occasionally write for anti-politics, because essentially it is anti-politics, and it's about, you know, in a meta sense, drawing yourself out of that and saying, we know what you're doing, we know what we're doing, and we're going to say all this stuff openly. It's the stuff that can't be said, because this is the stuff, this is the in-group rhetoric of the elites, really.
Yes.
They know this.
Yes. Or they at least implicitly follow this pattern.
Yes.
You know, it is dictated to them who the enemy of the month is and who the friend of the month is.
Yes.
And that will continue on until the situation, much like it did with Stalin, changes within 18 months.
The second quote, I'll try and have a bash.
It's from the therefore, through. I think this is the one that goes on to two pages.
It is, yes. But there's
This is
about 6 pages later. This is page 70 of Carl Smith's Southern Collection. But he goes on to say that, therefore, the criterion of the friend-enemy distinction does not at all mean that a certain person must entirely be the friend or enemy of a certain other, or that neutrality may not be possible or politically sensible. It is simply that the concept of neutrality, like every political concept, is also subject to the ultimate presupposition of a real possibility of a friend and enemy grouping. If there were only neutrality on Earth, not only war neutrality itself would therefore be at an end, but just as every policy, including a policy of avoiding conflict, is an end when the real possibility of conflict ceases to exist at all.
See, there again is this understanding of massive power in this.
Yeah.
That if you are the person that can declare conflict or declare peace, you know, you almost have a sort of godlike power to see what is and isn't the neutral position.
Yes. It also allows you to basically, you know, allows you to declare neutrality. It's what it does. It allows you that power, the power to declare something as neutral or someone as neutral, as not part of this, is part of the sovereign power. It again is another friend-enemy distinction. To leave a group out of friend-enemy distinctions is of itself a form of, you know, friend-enemy distinction.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great way of putting it. The mere possibility of this decisive case, the case of a real conflict, is always decisive, as well as a decision whether the case exists or not. Like, that's basically what he's saying there. A world in which the possibility of such conflict has been completely eliminated and disappeared, an ultimately pacified globe, would be a world without the distinction between friend and enemy, and consequently a world without politics. There might be in it many perhaps very interesting oppositions and antitheses, rivalries and intrigues of all kinds, but no conceivable opposition on the basis of which men might be required to sacrifice their lives and empowered to shed blood and kill other men. Again, for the definition of the political, it does not matter whether one wishes to create such a world without politics as an ideal situation. The phenomenon of the political can only be grasped by referring to the real possibility of friend and enemy groupings, regardless of the resulting religious, moral, aesthetic, and economic evaluation of the political. Basically, again, what he's hinting at here is the fact that if they did want to unite the globe, we'd need something like Bluebeam.
No, he does. It's not here, but it's somewhere around about here where he literally states that for humanity to come together as one, it must find some enemy that exists entirely outside of humanity. Which is part of the reason why he thinks that globalism isn't necessarily likely.
Yeah.
But inversely, to me, it's like, well, if they wanted globalism, then maybe
they'd have to do.
Do you want me to continue on with the rest of it?
Yeah, you can. I don't know, Trigg, do you want to read some of this? Do you want to read from where it says war?
War, yes, go on then. Sorry, I just got attacked briefly then for a moment. I had to take my microphone off. Right, war. As the most extreme political means, reveals the possibility of this distinction between friend and enemy, which underlies every political idea, and is therefore only meaningful as long as this distinction is actually present in mankind, or at least actually possible. On the other hand, a war waged for purely religious, purely moral, purely legal, or purely economic motives would be senseless. A friend-enemy grouping is therefore also a war, and cannot derive from specific oppositions of these areas of human life. A war need be neither pious nor morally good nor profitable. Today it is probably none of these things. This simple observation is often confused by the fact that religious, moral, and other oppositions can intensify into political oppositions and bring about the decisive conflict grouping according to friend or enemy. But when this conflict grouping occurs, the decisive opposition is no longer purely religious, moral, or economic, but political. The question is then always only whether or not such a friend-enemy grouping exists as the real possibility or reality, regardless of which human motives are strong enough to bring it about.
Basically, what he's saying there is that you can have massive moral disagreements with people, massive religious disagreements with people, but those only really boil over when they become political disagreements.
Yeah. There's almost, as well, there's like a weird sort of like argumentation ethics kind of thing that he's got going on there as well, where he's suggesting purely by the nature of conflict and the fact that we exist in a limited space in almost all senses.
Yeah.
This creating friends and enemies is like an inherent part of the human experience. That having people that are for you that don't take your stuff sort of consequently means that if people aren't part of that, then in some ways they may be against you and want your stuff. And specifically once you get into the sort of democratic state, that is the only possibility.
Well, what he's also saying is that, you know, not all politics is war, but all wars are political.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that to organize men into groups that will go as far as to kill each other requires something else rather than just cultural, moral, or religious differences, because those exist throughout the world very peaceably. I'll read this last paragraph then. I really like this bit. This bit's great.
I did say it's a brilliant bit of text.
Nothing can escape this consequence of the political. If the pacifist opposition to war was so strong, then it could drive the pacifist to war against non-pacifists, into a war against war that would prove that it really had a political strength because it would be strong enough to group men according to friend-enemy. That's fucking great, because it's a bit mind-twisting, but you have to realize that if people really want to politically commit to pacifism and that they think it's
to be willing to wage war for it.
That the pacifist must be willing to wage war and go, right, we're going to kill everyone who wants war. We're going to kill all the warmongers, and then we'll have world peace, which is essentially really what the democracy stuff is saying.
Yeah.
You have, it is really a, it is.
I'm very tempted to post that quote on its own as an image on Twitter and just annoy people by just being like, this is why I don't believe in the nap.
You already get vegans and vegetarians wanting to kill meat eaters because of the cruelty to animals, which is just, don't even get me onto that one. But
if the will to prevent war is so strong that it no longer shuns war itself, it has become a political motive, i.e. it affirms, if only as an extreme eventuality, war and even the reason for war. Again, a lot of the war of democracy stuff is predicated on the idea that democracies are essentially pacifist towards, you know, other democracies, and that we all must be democratic to prevent war. It's self-reinforcing hegemony. It's very clever rhetoric, but when you see it presented like this, it becomes nonsensical. At present, this seems to be a particularly promising way of justifying wars. The war then takes place in the form of the absolute last war of mankind, i.e. how the Great War was framed up until the Second World War. this is the last big war until the next one, guys. It's like people who think they're dieting and they just keep eating. It's like, right, this is the last burger until the next burger. Such wars are necessarily especially intense and inhuman wars. Yeah, going beyond the political, they must at the same time degrade the enemy in moral and other categories and make him an inhuman monster, which must not only be repelled but definitely destroyed, i.e. is no longer merely an enemy to be pushed back within his borders. Again, complete surrender, total surrender, the idea of the destruction of Germany and Imperial Japan, that they, you know, that their existence itself is a danger. But the possibility of such wars shows especially clearly that war still exists today as a real possibility. And it is on that alone that our friend-enemy distinction and the realization of the political depend. I don't really have much else to add to that. His whole point about the fact that ideological zealotry, especially in the pursuit of peace, a war of the pacifists would be possibly the most brutal war we've ever seen, because they thought once they won, they would eliminate war. Again, that's the whole point, though. That all war, modern war, especially total war, is always framed as almost a war of the pacifists. That Britain frames itself, especially in World War I and World War II, as being the reluctant defenders. That they are the roused pacifists drawn into action by the evil aggression of specifically Germanic enemies. And in the Second World War, ignoring when we talk about the Stalin provocation and outright invasion of other foreign nations, that this is the myth that, you know, all modern wars are fought in a sense of good versus evil to be the last war ever, we promise.
Yep. And so I'm going to take the picture off and I'm going to leave the image of was that
that's bikini, that's
that is bikini atoll. Yeah,
that is bikini atoll. Yes.
Ruined some very nice islands. I wouldn't go and take your holiday.
Yeah, mutated
there.
Some very nice wildlife as well.
Yeah.
But I think it's honestly one of, you know, we've talked at great length about how good some of the San Francis stuff is. But once you've begun to grasp that stuff and you're willing to see the kind of almost universal logic behind it,
yeah,
Schmidt just becomes like another sledgehammer to take to this whole historical narrative.
But
because he almost in a very like, it's like he's explaining it to you like you're like a 5-year-old that doesn't understand something that's very obviously contradictory.
Yes.
Like, you can't be a pacifist. Are you going to have a war against war? Like it's like you tell a child off because it's so stupid.
It really get to the heart of like the, when you talk about the contradiction of the nap, in that you'd have to have a war against aggression.
Mm.
You'd have to be an aggressive non-aggressor.
I mean, managed to have a war against terror, for God's sakes. Like,
that's the whole point.
It's like mentalist.
But it is. It's war against terror is an absurdity that tips its hat towards the friend-enemy distinction stuff.
Yes.
That they are able to say that there are, you know, there's the war on terror, which is never-ending and open-ended, but so really is most other war. The distinction is arbitrary in many cases. What it is a war by the friend against the enemy, and that is all warfare and, to a degree, what he talks about here, all politics really ever is. It is a ever-spiraling, you know, combination of friend-enemy distinctions. And all political activity falls under these auspices. And unless you are playing by that rule set, unless you understand that implicitly or explicitly, you are always deemed, you know, you're always deemed to be naive and to most likely lose.
Yeah, well, there is no winning that war.
Well, as he described before,
unless you're Raytheon.
If you aren't capable of seeing... Maybe there's a preface to this whereby if we make the assumption that this is how politics operates, if you aren't capable of doing this, if you aren't capable of segregating your enemy and man as, you know, different ethical structures and different ways to approach people, then you shouldn't bother because you're just wasting your time.
There's a great Bend quote there from Gaius Nautius Caesar, who's donated $5. He says, "The world will know of my peaceful ways by force."
Yeah, exactly.
Yes,
it's Carl Schmitt has summed up by Bender in Futurama, but it's true. It is the core contradiction at the heart of the wars for democracy, that these are altruistic. You know, these are wars for peace, essentially. And it is the contradiction of all of this stuff. All of this stuff is brought about by this and by these high-minded justifications for essentially boiling people down to friend enemies and on ever grander scales.
Yes.
And when you begin to see this, you begin to see all the stuff of Hopper and Cunot Ledin and, you know, Burnham is filtered through Francis and, you know, some of the Ted Kaczynski stuff we'll get to, in that the revolution of mass and scale when combined with the friend-enemy distinction of politics is always going to bring about these horrible wars.
Let's not forget the ever-increasing efficiency of technology and the ability to massacre one another.
Yes, and all you end up doing by leveling up the political is leveling up, you know, the potential for the scale of war and the death.
We might need to bring it in as a separate thing at some point, but we could frame so much of the post-democratization stuff as this is agitation,
yeah.
This is integration.
It is.
This is you. This is them defining the enemy. This is you being forced to comply with the enemy.
Well, there was this mass euphoria in 1945, which is why it stands as their year zero. There was this mass euphoria and this. The period 45 to 50, sorry, we'll talk about next time, is possibly the most rapid and blatant period of integration after mass agitation you will ever see. And it is so obvious what they are doing. They are even just saying it in some cases, because they have been granted so much power by what happened during the Second World War that they are able to... By 1950, by the time we get to the end of our democratization period, and we'll have a couple of theory specials after this, because we need to talk about some of the generalities of democracy, some of how it functionally works, removed from the time period, the processes of voting, things like that. We're going to basically do a democracy as function and democracy as kind of concept special in the abstract.
Yeah, I think maybe the best frame, and that would be something like democracy as an aspect of technological society.
I'm going to talk about the fake ideas of antiquity as well, and the myths of democracy, possibly. I'll think about a structure that probably. There needs to be at least a pure theory episode after this. Well, after the next one. But we are finally going to end our time periods. Well, not next time, but the time after. Because next week we're going to have a quick chat to Mr. Academic Agent.
Yes, we are.
Yes. Oh, cool.
He has done a lot of thinking on the stuff that we're going to be moving into.
Yes.
But always once again framed in this mythos as what he calls the sort of boomer truth regime. You know, this notion that all the people that grew up post this stuff only ever knew this stuff.
Yeah.
And the way that Churchill only ever, you know, let's assume that he only ever really understood the Cecil Rhodes kind of dream. You know, the boomers and the silent generation, or most of the boomers, only ever knew, like this dream, this blighty, you know, keep calm and carry on sort of spirit.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is. They are, as we will go into when we eventually get to all of the stuff. Again, I thank you guys for bearing with us with this. I've not been as heavy with the promotion of the channel and some of the collaborations, and you know, I've been had a lot of people who have asked me to go on their channels and come on this channel, but we honestly haven't had the time because I think this democratization stuff is so important. Because right now it is a bit obscure and we haven't done the best job of promoting it, but this is something I'm going to refer people back to for possibly the next 5 years.
Yeah, this stuff is basically evergreen, and as we discussed the other day, may at one point possibly appear in a different form.
Yeah, we are hoping at some point to turn this into possibly some kind of book, but that's a project for at least a year, possibly even more, because I've never written a book before.
I don't, neither of them. But...
and I have broken hands and can't write, so no.
Yeah, yeah. Trig's there for moral support.
I can post cat pics. That's my mission at the moment. Anyone that's following my Twitter account has gone from political snarkery and the occasional retweet to lots of cat pics. And it's, yeah. And I seem to be getting a lot more traction with it that way. I think the internet seems to be.
Yeah. I think Lua for. If we're trying to sort of possibly round things off towards the end, hopefully one of the most important aspects that people will learn from both this and as we continue on is the importance of doing things for your own sake and for your own values. And almost to a certain extent, deliberately doing things that you shouldn't do, like meeting a bunch of right-wing people at social events.
Yes, yes.
Like you couldn't... say, for example, the 23rd of October in Manchester.
Oh, I completely forgot to show that at the beginning, but I will put that in the description, I think. At least I'll put them in the comments here. But we do have an upcoming, actually, in-person event. We've possibly, I don't know, we haven't fully secured a venue yet because we're going to stay a bit flexible. But we have nearly sold out of tickets. We are only, I think we might be selling some more at some point. I'm not sure. It depends on what venue we do end up getting and how much seating we do have. Cause luckily we have a couple kind of not in reserve, but we are at least in, you know, we can jump on one if the time, you know, desires it, but we have 19 tickets remaining. That's it. We have sold 41 of them already, and it will be in Manchester, but the 23rd of October, it will be in a, you know, a private function venue, and we're hoping to have 70 to 80 people there, depending on how many chairs we can shove into the place. Do come join us. That's nomosevents.co.uk. I put the link in the chat there, and I'll go and edit the description once this is over. But I've been trying to give people the chance because we are going to have some more speakers announced at some point, and I think once some of the, let's say, possible larger speakers announced, there'll be new tickets left within a day. So
yeah, quite possibly.
We've
get them while they're hot.
yeah, get them while they're hot, basically. We possibly after the event will release a breakdown of where costs have gone because we aren't trying to make profit on this.
Mm.
We will at best be having a bit left over for the deposit next time. That's all we'll probably have. But do in-person stuff's very important, as we've talked about a little bit on some of the non-democratization streams, the localism stuff, and the in-person gathering stuff is the only way we're going to actually affect any change in the medium term, even, I think. Mm. So do come see us, do come say hi if you're in the UK and can travel to the north of England. Anyway, thank you guys for joining us today.
I was going to say the only other thing really to mention after that is that from live events earlier on during the weekend, last weekend, there will be stuff that me and you will be putting up on the channel at some point in the next week or so.
Yes, within the next week we'll have both of our speeches from the Shieldings event. I presented mine there, you didn't, sadly, even though they're meant to go together. But there will be my speech, then probably your speech, because I think one does lead into the other.
Yeah.
But we'll have 45 minutes.
You are supposed to be getting sent a video copy of that, I believe.
Yes, I am. I'm aware of that. I only found that out like today.
But... Yeah, because supposedly the live unpopular opinions that was basically just me and AA and another person interventioning Sargon about being a leftist should be uploaded at some point somewhere as well.
Fair enough, fair enough. Well, that was quite funny, but yeah, we'll there's more stuff coming in future, and I am hoping to generally cross-pollinate this channel with more content creators as the opportunity presents itself, but right now I'm just basically struggling to do these regular Thursday streams.
There's a lot of work amongst the other stuff we've got going on at the moment.
But anyway, I'm going to say goodbye now because I need to go to bed because I'm doing some babysitting tomorrow morning.
I shall say goodbye as well then.
And I will. Again, I will also.
Thank you to everyone who's tuned in. Thank you to the people who've donated, and thank you to the people who continue to be our. I can't just say patrons. It's members here, isn't it?
I don't know. Just when anyone ever asks you what happened between, or how did we get here. But why is it the situation that is? Just refer them back to this stuff.
Yeah. Now, that's what I've been doing. And thankfully, a lot of people have been working through it. I still see the old videos getting basically hundreds of views a week. They are slowly ticking up between them. So, yeah, that it's a worthwhile project and it's worth the work. But boy, is it a lot of work. And you help out immensely. So I will say thank you while you're actually still here on stream. Because we do try and shout you out every week. But you are basically... You know, the main researcher for this show. So,
sorry, it was
thank
my
you for
info.
That. Anyway, good night, folks.
Good night.
Anyway.